Thanks very much, Lucien. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's great to be back at PI. So, yeah, I'm going to talk about relativistic quantum possibilities and also relativistic quantum impossibilities. And the sort of starting point here is everything we've learned about non-relativistic quantum mechanics and the importance and the interest in identifying tasks which separate quantum mechanics and classical physics, either because they're possible classically and impossible quantumly, or vice versa, possible quantumly and impossible classically. So I've got a list of, by no means complete, but a list of examples to get to grips with here. Bell's theorem, we could think of Bell's theorem as a game. Alice and Bob are separated like this. They get a bit, a random bit that's supplied to them externally, so they don't predict it in advance. B is Bob's bit. A is Alice's bit. They have to output a single bit, X or Y. The rules are they win if the X or X plus Y is the same thing as the logical product of A dot B. The question is whether they can win with probability greater than 3/4 or not. It's quite easy to see there's a trivial classical strategy that will give you probability 3/4. And as we all know, the answer is yes, in quantum mechanics, they can do it with probability greater than 3/4. Whereas classically, 3/4 is the absolute algebraic bound. Another famous example that was rather important in getting quantum cryptography and quantum information theory on a firmer footing is the no-cloning theorem. And here the idea is, we could think of this maybe one party, Alice, their input in quantum state, it's a random input from their perspective, so they don't know what the state is, it's psi. And they're supposed to output two faithful copies of psi. And of course the no-cloning theorem tells us whatever they do, whatever they put in this box, however they process it, they can't do that. Classically, of course they can. And there's a whole line of beautiful results. The no-broadcasting theorem, which Chris Fuchs and Richard Joser and Schumacher and others proved a few years later. The no-deletion theorem of Bronstein and Patti. And a sequence of other extensions of the no-cloning theorem. And we're also familiar with tasks, the whole of quantum information science, really, to good approximation, is about tasks in which quantum mechanics either gives you a crucial advantage over classical protocols, or they're simply impossible classically, impossible quantumly. So, for instance, quantum key distribution, the idea here now is that Alice and Bob are going to send classical and quantum signals back and forth through unknown territory in which eavesdroppers might be lurking. The question is, given that they start by sharing a small random key, can they generate an arbitrarily long random key and so achieve secure communication? And as we all know, the answer is quantumly yes, providing the eavesdropper's not too active, and classically no. And even if the eavesdropper's too active, all the eavesdropper can succeed is doing is jamming the channel rather than actually successfully eavesdropping. Here's a very old example, no signaling. We've known since really we knew quantum theory. If Alice and Bob share some state, and this blue line in the center here now, this is some sort of separation. So either they're separated either by locality or just because we have physical reasons to think that these two systems are not interacting. Whatever state they share, Alice gets a random bit that she couldn't predict in advance, X, there's nothing Bob can do that will allow him, by acting on his subsystem, to work out the value of X. These big blue crosses are supposed to show impossibility. And a very nice, I think important generalization of this was found a couple of years ago by Pavlovsky and others, the principle of information causality. So we now extend the game. We still have a separation here between the two systems. we have a restricted classical channel. So now the game is n bits are input to Alice. She doesn't know them in advance. She could communicate any m bits, where m is smaller than n, that she wishes to Bob. Is there any way that Bob, by acting on stuff that's under his control over here, that might include pre-shared quantum states with Alice, can learn more than m bits about Alice's random input? The answer is no in relativistic quantum theory, and indeed in quantum mechanics, and indeed in classical mechanics. And you might think that follows directly from the no-signaling principle, but it turns out that's not true. The answer can be yes in general no-signaling theories. It happens to be no in quantum mechanics. And that's intriguing. It gives us maybe some further reason to think that quantum theory is special, maybe some insight into why nature's picked out quantum theory. Okay, so I'm going to come back to this diagram, but I want to throw it to you right at the start. I want to try and think more generally about questions like those in the context of relativistic quantum theory. And here's a reasonably general framework for thinking about such questions. For the moment, I'm just going to worry about one party, but it might be a party who controls separated regions. So maybe Alice is living in here, but also in here. Think of Alice as an organization. So she has agents in this region, agents in this region. She could do whatever she likes inside these regions of space-time, but not outside. And she is going to receive inputs. These are the red arrows at some set of points in space-time, at the edges of these regions. She knows probability distributions for the inputs and the input points, but she can't generally predict either the inputs or the points. And she's going to be asked for outputs that depend on those inputs. So these are the green things at some other set of points. Let's call them QI. And again, there may be some probability distribution about these queries, and she won't, in general, be able to predict the actual points, QI, although she knows something about a probability distribution for them. She knows something about the class of possible queries, but maybe not the precise queries that are going to be made. So I said I wanted to think about relativistic quantum theory, and that raises an obvious question. What are we actually talking about here? What we would like to be talking about, I guess, is some rigorously defined relativistic quantum field theory that includes the Standen model and ideally is a complete description of nature, at least within Minkowski space. So maybe we're happy to exclude gravity for the moment. But we don't actually have a precise, rigorous definition of such things. What we have is a great deal of folk wisdom and very strong intuitions. I go so far as to say intuitive understandings of what operations we can carry out, and at least of many operations we can't carry out, on physical quantum states in Minkowski space. So I want to work with the folklore. And I claim we can prove both possibility and impossibility theorems based on things that we all think we know, we all believe. And that there's three reasons for doing this. They're interesting. They teach us something potentially new about relativistic quantum theory and separate it from other theories. They have, it turns out, significant applications for quantum cryptography in particular, and potentially also quantum computing. And most ambitiously and most tentatively as well, maybe this is even a good way to think about axiomatizing and making better sense of relativistic quantum theory. If we can list enough properties, maybe we can get further in defining rigorously what the theory actually is. At any rate, what I want to assume for today is pretty uncontroversial, I think. I want to assume if we're working in Minkowski space, we look at any space like hypersurface, we have some physical system in mind, there's a quantum state defined on that hypersurface, so this is psi1 defined on S1. And if I look at any other hypersurface, say S2, physics gives us some unitary operation that tells us how to evolve psi1 to the state site here on S2. I also want to assume that, at least in principle, if we're talking about point-like systems, if we're talking about a localized qubit, for instance, and we have in mind some local unitary on just that qubit, I would assume that we can implement that just by deforming the surface a little bit, and we can make that little bit arbitrarily small. Just think that we put in something to implement that specific quantum gate on that point there, and leave the rest alone. Question? So you're right. I mean, rigorously, it's not defined. But intuitively, it's whatever. What to say about this? Effectively point-like. Would you be happy with that? No. So something whose spread in position space is not really relevant to the unitary we're applying. So, for instance, the spin of a particle, something like that. Almost any standard encoding of a qubit that doesn't depend on position? Something which takes up a small volume in space. Okay. Okay, so, yeah. Fair enough. Okay, so effectively point-like, I should say. Okay, so now I want to look at an incredibly simple task, which I'm going to give the name summoning in quantum state. So our picture now is we've got two different parties, and it's important they can keep stuff secret from each other. And because it simplifies the task, I'm going to idealize a bit. I'm going to assume that both of these parties have representatives absolutely everywhere in space and time. And at the same time, they can keep stuff secure from each other. So if you don't like that idealization, it's fine. We can. It's not essential to any of the definitions. You can just think of a network of agents spread fairly densely in space and time, and those are Alice's, and another network spread fairly densely in space and time, those are Bob's, and secure networks joining all of Alice's agents and all of Bob's and making sure that it's set up so they don't overlap. So the game here is Alice chooses a random physical state. It lives in, say, a finite dimensional space, and Bob knows the dimension, but it's a pure state, and it's chosen with a uniform distribution over all states in that dimension. So he doesn't know the state. And they agree some starting point, let's call it P. And at that starting point, Alice hands the state over to Bob. And Bob knows he's got to look after it because he knows that at some point in the future, Alice is going to ask it for it back. But he doesn't know where in the future. He does know it will be in the future light cone of P. It would be pretty unreasonable of Alice to ask for it outside the future light cone. But he doesn't know at what point. However, at some point it will happen. At this point Q, Alice says, "Hey Bob, can I have my state back?" and asks him to return it. So I want to persuade you, I don't think it'll be hard, of three things. If we're talking about quantum mechanics in Galilean space-time, or we're talking about classical physics in Minkowski space-time, Bob can do this, at least up to our idealizing assumptions. He can comply with the summons. If we're talking about an unknown quantum state in Minkowski space-time, in other words, we're talking about relativistic quantum theory, he can't. So here's why. Let's start with the classical case. He's given the state at P. This is a classical state now, so he can measure it. And in principle, in our idealized model, he can measure it to arbitrary position. And he could just send along his networks the result of his measurement everywhere so he knows what the state is. And in particular, at the summoning point Q, well, he has available to him a complete description of the state. And again, we're idealizing, so effectively instantaneously, he could build it from that description and give it back to Alice. So that's not a problem. If we're talking about quantum mechanics in Galilean space-time, well, now he can just, for instance, hold the state, here it is, rho, at the same point, and, yeah. So this slide is about classical physics in a classical state. And that's why it doesn't apply. Okay, but this slide's about quantum physics, and so he can't do that. But it's non-relativistic quantum physics, so he can just hold it. And when he gets a summons at somewhere Q, he could just send a signal arbitrarily fast, so to speak, to himself or to his agents everywhere else, saying, hey, I need the state. So the signal goes there. The state's being held here. It gets sent back to Q. The delay can be effectively zero. So that's not a problem. On the other hand, and the last question just touched on this, it's clear that neither of these strategies are going to work in relativistic quantum theory. The first one doesn't work because of the no-cloning theorem. You can't send copies of the state everywhere or a description of the state everywhere. And the second one isn't going to work because of effectively the no-superluminal signaling. He can't send an instantaneous signal from Q prime to Q and then send the state instantaneously back to Q prime. Neither of those will work. So he's certainly got to try something different if he's going to have any chance. And actually, it's not hard to persuade yourself that whatever he tries, he's not really going to get anywhere. His problem is this. He gets the state at this point, P. He can certainly carry out whatever operations he likes instantaneously. So, for instance, he could choose to send it that way, or he could put it through some gate and which has more than one output and send part of it that way and part of it that way, or other things. But what he can't do is make his decisions for one summoning point, for instance, this one, Q0, depend on anything that's outside its past light curve. His optimal strategy for returning the state here is independent of whatever happened outside its past light curve. And similarly at Q1. And so we can give him the freedom to carry out whatever operations he likes here. Nonetheless, he could be confronted with a summons here, or indeed right here on the edge of the light cone. He could be confronted with there. If he's confronted with a summons, he's got to respond with something. He's got to produce some quantum state. And we can work out, given whatever he did here, what his optimal response is. Let's call it this one, row one, there. And his optimal response here, row two. And then ask how faithfully can both of those represent row. Well, if they did it completely faithfully, then he would have violated the no-cloning theorem. We just look at a space-like hypersurface S here, and another one S prime here. He had one copy of row input here, and he's outputted two copies there. So it's not going to work. You might worry that all the devil here is in the detail. You might worry that it's our idealizations that are doing all the work. So you could certainly think about slightly more sophisticated versions of this task, in which, for instance, when Bob's requested the state, he's got a bit of a region of space-time in which he's allowed to respond. You could allow him some margin for errors. After all, even in classical physics, in practice, he's not going to be able to perfectly measure an unknown state. And so you could argue maybe it's unfair to demand infinite precision in quantum physics either. Okay, so we could allow him to return approximately the same state, with fidelity close to the original rather than precisely one. Those are good variations to consider, but they don't change the basic picture. If we take these definitions, it's realistically the case, and not just ideally now, the case that Bob can comply with the summons in non-relativistic quantum mechanics or in relativistic classical mechanics. But we have stronger results than the no-cloning theorem. There are non-trivial bounds on how close you can come to cloning an unknown quantum state. And removing our ideal, and those apply here. So removing our idealizations doesn't actually affect the main conclusion. We run with no approximate cloning instead of no cloning. No approximate cloning plus no signaling implies no, not even approximate summoning in relativistic quantum theory. Okay. So what, if anything, is this observation good for? Well, first, is, whatever it is, it's not a mathematically sophisticated one. The no-cloning theorem itself is a one-line theorem, maybe two, and this is two, maybe three. It does seem to say something. I mean, maybe something small, but something new about the relationship between quantum theory and relativity. I'm still throwing this out as a question, but it's, and maybe it depends exactly how you frame your notion of task, but it seems to me at the moment that it's quite likely to be the first example of a simple information-related task that actually separates the theory that we think is probably correct, or at least closer to correct, relativistic quantum theory, from both non-relativistic quantum mechanics and from relativistic classical physics. Whereas all our previous impossibility results, Bell's theorem and so on, all apply, I think it's fair to say, already to non-relativistic quantum mechanics as well as to relativistic quantum theory. You can worry about measuring non-localized states. Well, it's true that holds in relativistic quantum theory, but it also holds in relativistic classical theories. So it's not, at least not immediately obvious to me how to find an impossibility task from them either. But maybe it could be done. So let's go back to the general framework. Queries in red, sorry, inputs in red, queries out in green. And let's look at these various results in that framework. They certainly all fit into it. So Bell's theorem, you could say, well, the region is here and here, and these are separated in space and time. Here are the inputs, here are the outputs, here's what you're trying to achieve. No cloning, again, you control this region, you're trying to produce two copies of psi, information causality, and so on. And no summoning, well, one way of framing that is, here's the region in black, here's a possible list of points at which the state could be asked. These are the cues, here's the input, can one comply with a request that could come here, or here, or here, or here, or here. No, you can't. Okay, well, one of the reasons why I think this may be interesting is that it does actually seem to be useful, despite its simplicity. So in particular, it has a very direct application to something that half the audience is familiar with, but I'm not sure everybody is, something that quantum cryptographers have been thinking about for a long time and has a long and interesting history. The problem of whether or not, and if so, how and where and in what way, we can achieve quantum bit commitment without the security condition on anything. Let me try and say a little bit about bit commitment for people who might not be familiar. So there's a standard story about bit commitment, which is something like this. Alice has a new way of predicting, say, stock market prices. She wants to persuade Bob that she's got a new way of predicting stock market prices, so she wants to give him predictions now and then prove to him later that they were accurate, and then he'll be impressed, and then he'll buy her services. But she doesn't want to just give him the data for free, because then he'll be able to exploit it. And make money without paying her for anything. So what she really would like to do is to encrypt the predictions, hand them over to Bob in an encrypted form, and later, after the fact, decrypt them for him. So if this is going to really work, she needs some guarantee about the encryption scheme. Ideally, what she wants is a guarantee that Bob can't decrypt her prediction until she gives him a key. Some extra data of some form. Maybe it could be classical, could in principle be quantum. On the other hand, he needs a guarantee that she is, once she's handed over the initial encrypted prediction, she is genuinely committed. She can't change her prediction. For instance, she can't set up two different keys which will decrypt two different predictions and then decide after the fact which key she's going to hand over and so which prediction she's going to decrypt for him. So there's definitely a tension between these two guarantees. And ideally, what they would like is for both of them to be based only on the laws of physics rather than any computational assumption. The picture here is something like this. Alice writes her prediction down, puts it in a safe, hands it over to Bob. That's the commitment. When she comes to unveil or decrypt her prediction, she hands over the combination to the safe, and then Bob can open the safe and pull the prediction out. But of course, there are lots of assumptions in this scheme. Bob can't crack the safe or use x-rays to get inside it, for instance. So we want something stronger than that. And this, boy, does this problem have a history. This problem has a history. So this was all a task that was of course, first devised by classical cryptographers. And there are lots of interesting classical protocols, which are provably hard to cheat if you assume that some computational task is hard. So, for instance, checking whether or not two graphs are isomorphic, or finding a factorization of a large number that's a product of two primes. There are classical bit commitment protocols based on the hardness of those problems. But they all necessarily rely on computational assumptions. There's no perfectly secure classical bit commitment protocol. The first quantum bit commitment protocol goes back, really to one of the first papers in quantum cryptography. It goes back to 1984. It was proposed by Bennett and Brassard. And they both showed that it was secure if there's some limitation on Alice's technology, but also that it's breakable if she is technologically unlimited, in particular if she can create error-free entangled states and if she can store quantum states in a memory indefinitely, she can break the scheme. So there was a great deal of optimism for quite a while that one could find something stronger than this scheme. One could find an unconditionally secure quantum bit commitment scheme. And in fact, Brassard and collaborators claimed in 1993, and these were and are very serious people, and it was a seriously made claim and taken seriously, to have proven that they had a secure quantum bit commitment scheme. It turns out that claim was incorrect. That was broken in 1997. And more generally, Myers and Lowe and Chow showed not just how to break that scheme, but also how to break a very large class of quantum bit commitment schemes, an apparently general class of quantum bit commitment schemes, at least for non-relativistic quantum theory, apparently general. Myers conjectured something even stronger than that. He conjectured that this result also applies to schemes that use relativistic signaling constraints as well as quantum theory. There we are again. Myers conjectured that. You might be noticing a bit of a pattern here in quantum cryptography. So that conjecture turned out to be too strong. One moment. Certainly the arguments underlying that conjecture turned out to be incorrect. It turns out that there are ways to evade this scheme if you take relativistic signaling constraints into account. And the ways that were found rely on Alice and Bob having two separated labs each. So Alice has one here and Bob one here, Alice another here and Bob another here. And communications that go back and forth between those labs. And they have to keep on communicating. So that's a constraint. And another constraint is you need a relatively large separation between this pair and this pair. So it's a practical scheme, but this separation would probably have to be on the order of 100 kilometers or so, even using the best available technology, in order to commit a single bit indefinitely. Nonetheless, it's there. And by the way, this is yet another illustration of our input-output diagrams and the potential power of thinking this way. It's certainly not vulnerable to the Myers-Low-Chow attacks. It's provably not vulnerable to those. It's provably not vulnerable to any classical attack, although it's a classical scheme. But it still remains a conjecture that it's secure against the most general quantum attacks. So what I want to talk about next is something much simpler. I'm not going to go through the details of this. I'm going to give you a quantum scheme that is provably secure. And it's based on the no-summoning idea that I mentioned previously. How does this work? Like so. I've got the conventions for bit commitment are that Alice commits the bit to Bob. So I now need Bob to be giving Alice an unknown state. Here it is, rho. He gives it a point P. Alice has got to decide whether to commit a 0 or a 1. If she wants to commit to the bit value 0, she takes this state and she sends it at light speed. I'm working from memory, one space, one time dimension. So she sends it at light speed along this ray here. And if she wants to commit to 1, she sends it in the opposite direction, also at light speed. And now, even when she wants to decrypt her commitment to Bob, persuade him that she was committed to 0, well, if she wants to do it to 0, it's going to have to happen on this ray, and she simply returns rho to Bob somewhere on this ray. She can choose when. If she wants to decrypt 1, she returns it to Bob somewhere on the other ray. There are lots of extensions of this, but in a nutshell, that's it. It's as simple as that. Why is this secure? Well, it's secure against Bob because we're assuming that Alice can send these things securely. So we're giving Alice, as we always do in this trustful quantum cryptography, some laboratory which is supposed to be under her control and protected against Bob's intrusions. And here, this laboratory has got to include the relevant light ray segments along which she's going to send the state. One way to think about this would be hardened optical fibers. Another very simple way of implementing, actually, at least in theory, would be for her to teleport, in which case she's pre-shared entanglement from here to here. She only needs to send a classical signal to complete the teleportation, and the classical signal contains no data about the state. I should say, by the way, whichever strategy she uses, if there's a worry that Bob could tell whether or not she's sending a state this way or this way, well, maybe she should then also send a dummy state the other way. But given our assumptions, in fact, of a secure lab, Bob shouldn't be able to tell. Okay, so it's secure against Bob pretty much by assumption. It's secure against Alice because of the no-summoning theorem, in essence. She can't... whatever she does here, there's no way for her to put herself in a position in which she could return rho independently at any two points on the two opposite light rays. Take a general point Q0 here, a general point Q1 here. Well, there's a space-like hyperplane running between them. And so it would violate no cloning in that reference frame. More generally, it's violating no summoning. We can and should be a bit more precise about that. Alice doesn't have to send the state either that way or that way. She could certainly be trickier than that. For instance, she could send it in a superposition of partly this way and partly that way. So you could ask, well, what can we really prove? Alice does that or something more general? Here's what we can prove. Given some actions that she chooses back at point P, where she's committing herself, we can again analyze the optimal state for her to produce if she wants to unveil a 0. Let's call this rho 0. The optimal state she could produce if she wants to unveil a 1. Let's call this rho 1. And then look at the probability that this will work. What's the probability Bob will believe her when she returns rho 0 to him? He's going to carry out a measurement and check that it's rho. And add that to the probability that he's going to believe her at 1. And the key the key question here is how close that sum is to 1. And the answer is it could be as close as one wishes. So it's 1 plus something that depends on the dimension of the Hilbert space here. And in fact, so this 1 over d maybe doesn't look all that good, but if you think about it in terms of the number of qubits, this is actually good. This is decaying exponentially in log d, which is really the relevant parameter, the number of qubits that are handed over here and that LS has to transmit and return. You might worry whether this is really a sensible whether this is the right definition of security. I'm very happy to discuss that afterwards, but people have thought about quantum bit commitment quite a lot, and I think there's a general consensus it's, if not the only possible one, a very reasonable one. Okay, all of that was in 1D, but it works in reality. It works in 3D, and in fact it works even better, because now every possible light-like direction can code for a different data value. So with a single state, Alice can commit not just a bit, but in principle an arbitrarily long string of bits by simply sending the state in one of a large number of possible different directions. And that our result still applies because of a simple but nice geometric fact that if you take any 2 points on distinct light-like rays through P, they're space-like separated. Okay. In practical terms, well, I'm not sure how far you could or would want to push this, because practically speaking, the amount of data you commit is bounded. You have to worry about another resource, which is how precisely Alice can choose the direction and how precisely Bob could tell the direction she chose. And eventually you're going to bump up against serious constraints in those precisions. But in principle, at least, we have a scheme for committing an indefinite amount of data in 3 plus 1 dimensions. I mentioned the no-go theorem, the Myers-Chow theorem. I did say that that theorem wasn't set out in the relativistic context. It's still a natural question. Why doesn't Myers and Lochow's result apply here? Well, the answer is, as with most no-go theorems, they tend to be partly challenges to the imagination. There's almost always some tacit assumptions in there. And there's one which I think hasn't really been properly recognized previously in Myers-Lochow's result, which I don't think affects the situation with non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but certainly does in relativistic quantum theory. Their no-go result assumes that if there's a quantum state that defines the zero commitment and another quantum state that defines the one commitment, and everything is set out, then there has to be some unitary map taking one to the other. And if Alice knows that map, she can implement it, and if she can implement it, she can follow the protocol committing itself to a zero and then apply the map later and rotate the zero to a one and so cheat. Okay, I've compressed, but in essence, that's what it boils down to. In our protocol, it's certainly the case that Alice knows what the relevant unitary is. She knows her zero commitment was a qdit in general going this way, and if she wants to map it to a one, she's got to make it into a qdit going that way. And the relevant unitary is a translation. But of course, she can't actually implement it. The knowledge is useless to her. It would violate causality for her to be able to physically implement this, the translation operator. So the Myers-Lochow attack doesn't apply. I wanted, in the last 10 minutes or so, to touch on another cryptographic problem that's attracted quite a lot of interest lately that also fits into this general question of relativistic possibilities and impossibilities. And I guess I'm really trying to persuade you That there's a playground here, that we may be just seeing one or two early examples of. Just as a great deal of quantum information science came from thinking carefully about possible and impossible results, I'm beginning to wonder whether it isn't true that we can do something like that all over again with a relativistic quantum theory, with a whole new slew of results. So I see this just, I mean, it's an interesting example in its own right, but I see it also as a motivation for thinking more about this general class of questions. Anyway, here's the problem. You're Alice, you have fixed laboratories in various places, and there's some object that you care about, and you're going to fix a tag to it. And just to simplify things, we're going to assume that you've got some sort of super glue, so that your gold bar or whatever has a tag stuck to it, and there's nothing anybody can do about that. And your tag itself is physically secure. And what you want to do is to guarantee that it stays in the same place. It's supposed to be in a museum, something like that. You're sending signals back and forth from your distant laboratories, checking that it's still where it's supposed to be. So there's the tag T. Here are you, here, here, and here. And if we were working in 3D, you'd probably need at least four of you. And here are the signals going back and forth. Your enemy, Eve, wants to fool you. So she wants to send signals from somewhere else. She can't break into the tag, remember. And she can't be sitting actually inside your laboratories, but she could be anywhere in this region. So let's say Eve occupies this purple ring here. She wants to spoof your tagging protocol so that you can't tell the difference between the genuine protocol and Eve's communications to you. And she can do whatever she likes in this region, and she, in principle, she's allowed to share whatever resources she likes between different points in this region. And her motive, I mean, maybe she just wants to trick you for the fun of it, but more likely her motivation is that once she's done that, well, now she can slowly move the tagging device away, and you can't tell, and she can spirit away and steal your gold bar, and bad things, bad consequences ensue. So this is another one of these quantum crypto stories which has claims and counterclaims and eventual consensus. And it's still very much an ongoing story. So at least, to my knowledge, at least three independent people or groups of people have worked on this under various names, quantum tagging or quantum position verification. And in particular, this group, Chandran et al., thought about not just tagging, but a much more general class of position-based quantum cryptographic problems and protocols. I think that's extremely interesting, but I'm going to focus today just on the tagging one. Various schemes were proposed. Chandran et al. And Mullaney in 2009 and 2010 both claimed to have produced schemes that were provably secure and to have proved their security. That turned out to be wrong. Bill Munro and Tim Spiller and I showed that there were actually rather simple teleportation-based attacks which allow Eve to spoof those schemes. We and also Hoi Kwan Lo and Lau listed some other schemes. We just weren't sure whether they were secure or not. Lo and Lau conjectured theirs were. That turned out to be wrong as well. So, let me skip from here to here. Chandran et al. And also Harry Boorman and Christian Schaffner produced a beautiful general attack on tagging of schemes that relies on some very nice, very, very beautiful earlier work by Lev Weidman on local quantum measurements, and shows that a very large class of schemes, including all the ones listed in this sentence, are in fact provably insecure. Meanwhile, there's a subtlety here. The possibility or otherwise of security seems to turn out to depend crucially on exactly what properties you assume for the tag, and in particular, whether it can store a secret, whether Eve can or cannot read the information stored within it. So if you assume that the tag can hold secrets, secure quantum tagging is possible. I'll describe a scheme for it in a minute. This was supposed to decrypt all the initials, a list of references. If anybody liked them, I'll give them to you later. Let's think in our general framework. Again, these are the things Alice controls, the AI. Here's the tag, which she at least originally built. Here are her inputs in red arrows. Here are the outputs that are supposed to be returned to her in green. We've got to have a protocol that the tag can work with. So this thing over here must be possible. And what we're trying to find is both at the same time for this to be possible and for it to be impossible for Eve, who's occupying everywhere except these red regions, to replicate the protocol and produce the same outputs given the same queries. Just to give a little bit of the flavor of some of the ideas that were played with. Here's the scheme that I said turned out to be breakable by Chandran et al. I'm going to give you the one-dimensional version, but it all goes up to three dimensions without any problem. So the idea is very simple. Alice chooses one of four states, 0, 1, or coherent superpositions, plus or minus, at random, and sends a whole sequence, a random sequence of these things from the left. She chooses randomly a basis, encoded in a bit, sent from the right. And these are supposed to converge pairwise. So this state here arrives at T at the same time as this basis choice. And T is supposed to interpret this as an instruction to measure the state in the relevant basis. So T carries out a measurement either in the 0-1 basis or the plus-minus basis, and simply reports the results back. So sends back at light speed, both to A1 and to A0, the outcome of the measurement. It turns out that there was another implicit assumption being made here. Chandran et al., without quite recognizing it, had assumed that Eve, who's trying to spoof this scheme, has no pre-shared entanglement. And if Eve, once you notice that that's an implicit assumption, you immediately begin to get suspicious, and indeed, it's not at all hard to see how to break this scheme. All Eve needs to do is to receive the state, say, here at E0, carry out a teleportation measurement here, so sending two classical bits across, while keeping the result here, so that eventually she's going to have the measurement result both at E0 and at E1. And at E1, she carries out a measurement of the other half of the EPR pair in the basis B, as soon as she learns what it is, sends the result to E0, and again stores it here. So that eventually is going to be at E0 and at E1. So that we end up with a space-time diagram like this. Here's Alice's state. Well, here's the teleportation measurement result that's gone that way, and it's also been stored here. Here's the measurement on the second EPR state. That's been stored here, but it's also been sent here. And you could combine those three classical bits, either here or here, and work out the answer to the question Alice was trying to pose, which was what outcome does one get if one measures psi in basis B? And so Eve does that, and she returns the outcome to Alice. That's here and here. Those are the green lines. And you notice that as far as Alice is concerned, this is indistinguishable from the tag operating. Everything has gone just as fast as it could at light speed, that way and that way. And that's why the scheme is broken. The idea was to rely on light speed signaling constraints and somehow to assume that you couldn't do anything except get the state to T and then measure it. And that turns out to be wrong. More generally, and this is now the beautiful work of Bormann and co-authors, you could think of a very large class of schemes which generalize this, in which effectively T is carrying out some unitary operation. Even if you phrase it as though T should be carrying out a measurement, that's still just a unitary in a larger Hilbert space. So a very general strategy for tagging would be a scheme in which quantum states come in here and here. T is supposed to carry out some unitary and then return outputs at light speed this way and this way. It looks like a good idea. Maybe it is a good idea, but it isn't good enough for unconditional security. What Bormann et al. Show is that if you do something that generalizes the teleportation attack I described previously, but generalizes it in a very clever and not immediately obvious way, you can spoof anything like this. So you need, and again I'm going to skip through the details, but you need to carry out a multi-round teleportation protocol which has a small but finite chance of working at each given round, and it turns out that's good enough. Combining that with unitaries that depend on you over here, you can end up producing the relevant information and being able to return it, and in such a way that lights won't be able to notice. So again, without any delay that way or that way. Hence, in principle at least, all such schemes are insecure, although this, to actually have a 100% chance of working, this attack requires an infinite amount of entanglement. And so one might think that the schemes are sort of practically secure or practically nearly secure. On the other hand, it's not provable that that's a necessary feature of any possible attacks. I'm sorry, it's not proven that's a necessary feature. Maybe you can get away with less entanglement. I said the story is very different if a tag contains secrets. Here's why, in a nutshell. If the tag contains secrets, Alice can ask the tag for the secrets, and Eve, there's nothing Eve can do because she doesn't share the secrets with Alice or T. So Alice could send at light speed a query saying, send me the first secret bit, and T could send it back that way. She could do it here, she could do it from wherever she likes. As long as they have enough shared secrets, this will work. And all one needs is the speed of light and triangulation to guarantee that the tag is in the right place. Of course, that sounds like a scheme that's going to fail after a while because they'll run out of secret bits. But we could use quantum key distribution, for instance, between any pair, say A1 and T, to expand an initially finite string and keep generating shared secret bits indefinitely. And so one can implement secure quantum tagging. And maybe it's actually quite a useful practical application of QKD to do so. And one can do it indefinitely, as long as you assume the tag can hold secrets. And that's quite a reasonable assumption. It's in many other contexts in quantum cryptography, it's a standard assumption that one has secure devices. So this tagging discussion, I guess, highlights what seems to me an interesting subtlety. We might stick with the original question and say Eve can control a region R and nothing more, in which case the tag, which is outside her region, is totally inaccessible to Eve and she can learn nothing about it. You might want to look at the case where she could control R and she can also send signals, classical Landau quantum signals, through the complement of R. You might want to give her extra power. You might allow her to be able to read classical or quantum data in the complement of R, but not to be able to carry out non-trivial unitary maps. I think both foundationally and cryptographically, all of those are natural and interesting questions, and in crypto, each of them seems potentially practically relevant in the right context. Okay, so as I've tried to say already, I see this as a, these are sort of hopefully early illustrations of a class of questions that hasn't really been studied and should be. It seems as though we can learn new features of relativistic quantum theory by considering tasks that are both intrinsically both relativistic and quantum. Summoning is a very simple example. One hopes that with more thought one can find lots of other interesting examples. And yet it turns out to be cryptographically a very powerful example. There's a direct application to bit commitment. And by the way, some other cryptographic applications. Quantum tagging and position-based quantum cryptography are another natural class of applications with still some intriguing open questions as to exactly what is possible and impossible. And I hope, time will tell, but I hope there are many other interesting tasks. There seem to be lots of open questions, and hopefully many new quantum cryptographic applications. And that's really all I wanted to say. So thanks very much for your attention. I'll stop there.
Do we have questions?
Thank you. Can you explain how the QBC protocol you proposed is secure against BAP?
How the bit commitment protocol is secure against BOB? Is that the question?
The QBC protocol you proposed is how secure against BAP? I didn't understand.
I'm not sure I understand which protocol. The bit commitment protocol that I described?
Bit commit? Yeah, right. Yeah. That one.
Sure, let me flick back. So, it's secure against Bob because once he hands the state over to Alice, it's under her control, and it's inside her region, her laboratory. So she could decide whether to send it this way or this way. But Bob, she's doing this along some secure channel, a hardened optical fiber, for instance. And until she sends the state out of that region again and returns it to Bob, by assumption, he has no ability to read what's going on. You look as though you're not happy with that, sir.
Can it do the same thing in classical bit commitment story?
Well, you can certainly make the same. You can make the. I'm sorry. The assumption is a standard one that both Alice and Bob have secure laboratories in which the other party can't work at. And that's, we've seen that in classical. You're right, we could make a scheme that's secure against Bob this way in classical bit commitment, but it would be completely insecure against Alice. If Bob gave Alice a classical state and she was supposed to commit by sending it at light speed this way or this way, she could send it both ways and then return it to Bob along either light ray.
What I mean is in a classical bit commitment, in which Alice commit a bit in a paper into something very very strong enough.
Uh-huh.
So in that classical bit commitment, is it?
Okay. So what I mean. There's a sort of standard set of working assumptions in either classical or quantum mistrustful cryptography, including bit commitment. If you're thinking about something like the safe, Alice puts the bit inside the safe. We can't assume that the safe is simultaneously secure against Alice and against Bob. That would violate the standard assumptions. So the standard assumptions are that Alice has a secure laboratory and trusts nothing outside it, and Bob has a secure laboratory and trusts nothing outside it. And those must be disjoint. So if the safe is perfectly secure against Alice because it's inside Bob's laboratory, then it's also perfectly insecure against Bob because it's inside Bob's laboratory, and vice versa. Those are the standard rules of the game, and I think, by the way, they're quite reasonable assumptions. So there's no classical way to replicate security against both parties that this scheme gives.
So I wanted to ask about how a few other results fit into to your framework.
Okay.
In particular, key distribution based on no signaling and Bell inequality violations. So I guess one of the advantages of coming up with a relativistic protocol is that you might, where another non-relativistic protocol already exists, is that you may be able to weaken the security assumptions, so you don't need to assume the truth of quantum physics. So I guess I'm interested, you know, what are the, I would have thought that key distribution based on no signaling Bell inequality violations is a relativistic protocol. And what other tasks do we now know that we can get weaker security assumptions based on relativity?
Sorry, you would have thought that this was a...
So do you agree with that?
That
it's a relativistic protocol?
I agree it's basically a relativistic protocol. It relies on the generalized no-signaling hypothesis, yeah.
So I'm curious, what's the set of things we now know that we can weaken security assumptions based on relativity?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure I could download a comprehensive list, but let's see. As you say, key distribution based on no signaling is one important one. There are still conjectures here, but it looks like randomness is expansion, even randomness expansion where you don't have trust over the devices that you're working with. It looks as though no signaling still allows arbitrary randomness expansion. This bit commitment protocol, there's something slightly sort of crazy that's a little bit like oblivious transfer. So in standard oblivious transfer, Bob learns one bit from Alice and Alice doesn't know which bit. Here, this is a relativistic sort of distant cousin of it. Bob learns some data from Alice somewhere, maybe here or maybe here, and Alice is oblivious as to where Bob learned it. Off the top of my head, and tagging at least with modulo some assumptions about Eve's resources, I guess should be in the list. Off the top of my head, that's...
Two-party secure computation of certain sorts?
Do we know anything different about that? That's the right question, but I don't know of any positive results in that direction. At least. I'm probably missing one or two things, but if I take the spirit of the question right, it would be good to have some general classification of what relativity gives us on top of what quantum theory gives us. And I think we're very far from such a thing, and that's why there's so much work still to do here.
Yeah, I think somewhere very quickly what flashed by, but you said that you thought that it was impossible to make an instantaneous measurement relativistically, even in a classical theory. Was that correct? Did I say that correctly?
Yes, I did. No, I did say basically that. Yeah. Carry on.
So are you sure about that? I'm just wondering, because it's true that you can't sort of report the answer instantaneously, but couldn't you make a bunch of local measurements which all put together amount to a global measurement?
Right. Absolutely. So you could collect all the data locally and then bring it together later, and you have the answer. Yeah.
So I think that's different from the quantum case. where you can't make an ideal measurement on a space-like hypersurface, even if you let yourself bring it together.
We should talk about that, but I'm not.
Or you can't.
I mean, this
you can't make the collapse happen. Let's say.
Ah, that's different. Okay, so. I hesitate to commit myself too strong, but I think the spirit, what Weidmann's work is, shows, at least for a large class of these things, is that surprisingly you can do the same thing quantumly. You have a quantum state that's separated at a number of sites, and nonetheless you can carry out local operations together with pre-shared resources and gather enough information that you have the answer as soon as you bring it all together. So the question is,
when does the effect of collapse occur? Because if it occurs only when you bring it together, that would be one thing. But if it occurs when the measurement is made, then I believe you get violations of causality from that.
I don't think we need to talk about... I don't think we need to get into a discussion of collapse or effective.
Well, the thing is that it's...
It's just... I mean, you just obtain classical data at various points. Or quantum data, even at various points. I think there's a framing question here, which I'd like to get straight and haven't got straight. I suspect it may well be right that if you frame the question the right way about non-local measurements, you can find some important distinction between relativistic quantum theory and relativistic classical theory. But I don't immediately see a way to frame the question. Maybe somebody else does, and then I'd love to explore it more.
Okay.
Questions? I have one question. So I'm interested in the axiomatization you talk about. So what would be both the nature and the benefits that you envisage of such an axiomatization? Both the nature and the benefits. So would it be operational, mathematical, and would you do it in order to resolve some of the difficulties with quantum field theory, or what would be the benefits you imagine?
Okay, so any idea in this direction is speculative and ambitious, including the first one, but the first one's less than the rest. Mm-hmm. So the first one would be reduce this sort of slew of possible and impossible tasks to some reasonably simple set. We could do this, we could do this, we could do this, we can't do that, and we could derive everything else from that sort of list. That would give us a much clearer handle over applications to.
That would constitute an
axiomatization of what you can do in quantum information. So then I think what you're pushing for is the more ambitious thing, that we actually find a more rigorous way of defining quantum field theory in terms of possibilities and impossibilities. I don't know whether that will pan out, and if so, I don't know how it will pan out. But it seems, it's an additional motivation on top of the others.
We'll see. Okay. Okay, so if there's no more questions, let's thank Adrian once again.